Call it a case of the blind leading the paparazzi.
It is the moment that's important to me, the instant. It's a conscious choice, even though I don't see the object, even if I'm getting a description, I could very well decide not to take that picture.
Pianist Henry Butler has been blind since birth. He's been a photographer for most of his life. Taking pictures is one of his passions, though he's never seen a single image he's shot. Musical moments and pulling the trigger on art. That's what we do. We're fully loaded on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, May 27th. I'm John Hockenberry. I'm in our partner studios at WGBH in Boston. I know it sounds like I was screaming for the Red Sox last night, but no, I went to a great concert. We're going to talk about that later on this morning. Farai Chidea is with us from New York. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. Well, you know, coming up this hour, we're going to take a look at Supreme Court justices, how they can pack a lifetime of surprises and headaches into the time that the presidents that have picked them have put them on the bench. David Souter certainly showed different stripes than some folks expected, and we'll see whether this would-be replacement could too. Plus, when and how can the government tell you how to take care of your kids? All this and more ahead, but first the headlines.
And in the headlines, bankruptcy. New developments this morning means General Motors is almost certainly going that way. A few minutes ago, GM said not enough of its bondholders are willing to trade their debt for company stock. GM has until Monday to file for Chapter 11. Chrysler's already there, of course. It's got a key court hearing on details today. The car company will officially ask a court for final permission to sell itself to Fiat. Before the Italian automaker can close the deal, the bankruptcy court will hear from various parties opposing the sale, including dealers, investors, and former employees. Farai?
A new survey shows that most leading economists predict the recession is going to end this year. Some think that you could see growth by the third quarter. That comes from leading forecasters from the National Association for Business Economics. Even they note that when the technical recession is over, we're still going to feel effects, including job losses. In North Korea, they're amping up threats today. It promises, quote, strong military measures, unquote, if South Korea stops and searches any North Korean ships. Yesterday, the South joined an American-led program that can stop ships suspected of smuggling weapons. South Korea had long avoided joining the group, fearing it would antagonize Pyongyang. South Korean media reports steam rising from North Korea's nuclear facility. That's a possible sign the government is weaponizing nuclear fuel.
President Obama's trip out west today is all about green. He's raising it for Democratic candidates at a Los Angeles fundraiser. He's also visiting a solar energy site to talk green jobs, and he'll be back in Washington early tomorrow. Farai?
The California Supreme Court says a ban on gay marriage remains in effect. This is a big story. We'll bring you a lot about it. Yesterday, it upheld Proposition 8. That's the ballot measure voters approved last November. Thousands of same-sex couples married before the ban kicked in, and the court says their marriages are still legal.
The S&P and the Dow both gained about 2.5% yesterday. Consumer confidence the reason. The Dow gets going at 84.73 this morning, the S&P at 910. When is personal freedom medical neglect? Does the state have an interest in your parenting techniques? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, in with John Hockenberry, and we have seen plenty of legal news, including the nomination of the first Latina for the Supreme Court. We'll have more on that shortly, but yesterday, the California State Supreme Court upheld Proposition 8. That's a ballot initiative banning same-gender marriage. It did leave a loophole, saying that thousands of gay men and lesbians who already got married remain married. Janine Rizzo married her partner in September. She was one of the plaintiffs in the case, and she spoke to us yesterday shortly after the decision.
When the announcement was made, I felt just a pang in my heart that we were now separated from our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters, and also separated as being less than equal to all straight couples because it wasn't a universal decision. So I took no comfort in hearing that the 18,000 marriages were intact.
Well, again, this is one of a married lesbian couple, and here to discuss their plight and the plight of thousands of other Californians, we've got John Schwartz. He writes on legal issues for our partner, The New York Times. He's here in studio. Great to have you here. And this issue has really been on the door of every agency. You had the San Francisco mayor, Gavin Newsom, say, everybody go get married, and people rush down to civil hall, get civil marriages in the city hall, and, you know, two tuxedos or two dresses, sometimes on men or women or whatever, tuxedo and a dress, all sorts of photographs, entire books and fortunes made on that. And they were nullified by the state, the marriages were. Then the California State Supreme Court legalized the marriages again. And then there was the ballot initiative. So how do these things work when you have so many competing government entities?
Well, anytime you've got competing government entities and issues that people feel passionately about, things can bounce around. Things can bounce around a lot in California because of the initiative process in which you can get enough signatures on people to sign signatures, and you can get a measure on the ballot. And that's what happened with this round, and that's what's going to happen again. Because it is almost certain that the people who lost this time will put together more signatures and fund their own initiative. These things just roll and roll, especially in California, where it's very easy to get something on the ballot.
Now, is this really about marriage? Marriage as a specific set of legal rights, or is this more a question of terminology? Because some people have tried to differentiate the two. As someone who looks at the law, is marriage very different from a civil union?
Well, it that's the key question that the court was trying to answer in its opinion. Chief Justice Ronald George of the California Supreme Court basically said you're getting everything but the word. You're getting every substantive right, everything but the word. And although in a sort of regretful paragraph he said, this might not be what we on the court believe in, but this is what the voters have decided, and we have to uphold that process. So what you end up with is almost saying separate but pretty much equal, which is deeply unsatisfying to the people who wanted gay marriage, because marriage is one of those things. It's not just a civil ceremony. It's a word fraught with meaning. It's why people who oppose same-sex marriage are so passionate about it, and why people who want same-sex marriage so desperately want it.
But John, is it possible here that the ballot measure initiative, the language of Prop 8, says that the voters can repeal a doctrine as valuable and constitutional as separation of church and state if they just believe that there's a moral religious dimension to marriage that they want enshrined in the California state constitution?
Well, that was the key question that the folks challenging Proposition 8 were asking. They said, how far can this system go? How far can an initiative go? And what they said was that Proposition 8, for all of its 14 words, went beyond a simple amendment to the Constitution and was something deeper, a revision that goes to core values. They said it shouldn't happen, and the Supreme Court said, actually, it can.
You know, this is one of those things where, again, the football has been tossed around, but it probably won't be the end. This is Polly Cooper. She is the one who is married to the first woman that we heard from.
And in any kind of civil rights battle, there's going to be setbacks, and this is no doubt a setback, but we need to be invigorated by this, and we need to actually rally more supporters, and what we need to do is go back to the ballot box.
All right, so that is a married lesbian talking about going back to the ballot box and fighting this out in what would be another ballot initiative?
Well, exactly.
One with different language, I'm assuming?
One with different language, one that says something, you know, if Proposition 8 said only marriage between a man and a woman is valid and recognized in the state of California, then this one would say that, you know, marriage is recognized. I mean, it would reverse it. It would come up with its own. And this is pretty much what the judge...
In Maine, they said between two people instead of between a man and a woman.
And that could be enough if it were passed to reverse it. And the Chief Justice George said in his opinion was that the underlying argument of the people fighting Proposition 8 was that it's just too easy to get an initiative passed. He said, the answer is not for us to change it, but for you to change it through the legislature. There's a different process for that, and it's their obligation to uphold these things.
John, can I ask you about the 18,000 who got a reprieve yesterday? Their marriages are legal because they came before the deadline when Prop 8 was passed. I mean, it seems to me that the fact that their marriages are legal creates a problem in the sense that this constitutional principle functions sort of like a credit card application deadline. It sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's not an absolute principle. Is that troublesome for constitutional lawyers?
Well, it could be. Anytime you've got people treated unequally, it can be a problem for constitutional lawyers. But in this case, what the court said was, you can't go back on this without – you can't make a rule like this retroactive without explicitly stating it. And 14 words of the proposition didn't say, and none of the marriages that were done before will be valid. And so despite the fact that those pushing Proposition 8 wanted those marriages nullified, without explicit language, it couldn't happen. And the court talked about all the sorts of things that could happen if you invalidated marriages – that people had relied on, that they had gotten married, that they had bought property, that they had gotten insurance, and that this would be so disruptive that the judges said, this is just something we don't do.
I want to take a turn here. We have been doing a lot of legal news, and particularly about the new nominee to the Supreme Court. There have been a number of civil rights cases having to do with voting rights and race in this term of the docket of the Supreme Court. By the time we have a new justice, whether it's Sotomayor if she gets confirmed or someone else, do you think that some of these gay marriage issues will bubble up in the next term or two of the Supreme Court?
Well, state issues tend to stay within the states, but there can always be a federal challenge. You could see federal challenges in California. You could see them. These issues are bubbling through the states now. We have five states that have approved same-sex marriage. More could come. The challenges could be based on federal constitutional grounds, conceivably, and you could see something getting to the Supreme Court. There's also a federal lawsuit against the Federal Defense of Marriage Act that is working through the courts now. So it could go all the way to the top.
The look at same-gender marriage as not just a state-by-state issue, but a federal issue is bound to come up as people look at the transportability or the transference of marriage as people move from state to state. It's a topic we've talked about a bit on the show. How do you think that kind of a challenge might come up? How might there be a challenge that says, we're a gay couple who got married in, you know, Maine, now we want to live in Tennessee? What kind of legal challenge would you have to mount to ask that it be recognized?
Well, if you got denied rights that you were allowed in another state, then you could file under equal protection. I mean, there are lots of mechanisms for fighting discrimination and unequal protection and lack of parity and comity between the states. In the personal realm, it would be interesting to see how that would go forward.
And it would be something that would go first, you think, to a state Supreme Court and then possibly higher if it went on appeal?
It would depend. If it were employment discrimination, there could be state laws, there could be federal issues. It would really depend on the circumstances of the discrimination.
But there is no federal statute making sexual orientation a protected class for employment, is there?
Not that I know of.
So the equivalent, I presume, would be some kind of a federal class that protected people's marriage rights. Like, there'd have to be, in order to file I'm not a legal scholar, as you can see, but in order to file
and
that
my law
of,
and my law degree only comes from a state school, so I might not be up to this.
All right. Well, we will leave that question to the future legal scholars, including Judge Sotomayor. When will gay marriages become portable across the states? Who knows if they even will? So we have to stay tuned. We've been speaking with John Schwartz, who writes on legal issues for the New York Times. Thanks for joining us, John.
You bet.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry, and we're going to be talking later this morning about a serious subject, neglect. Yesterday, a Minnesota judge ruled that parents can have custody of their son so long as they provided him with chemotherapy to treat his cancer, treatment they denied on religious grounds. We want to know, when is personal freedom medical neglect? Have you felt social pressure in your own parenting? Or what does society have to say about regulating parental decisions? Did you ever feel like you were outside of the mainstream? Maybe you do corporal punishment. What about experimental therapies? Tell your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. John?
Well, it's a big legal week, as Farai pointed out earlier on in the program. Joining us, still with us, actually, is John Schwartz, our friend for The New York Times, legal analyst for The New York Times, writes for our partner, The New York Times. Also joining us is Noah Feldman, who's the Bemis Professor of Law at Harvard University. He joins us from his home just across the river from where I am in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Noah, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
So both of you, listen, here is President Obama running down the resume of his new nominee for Supreme Court Justice to replace David Souter, Sonia Sotomayor.
She's been a big city prosecutor and a corporate litigator. She's spent 6 years as a trial judge on the U.S. District Court and would replace Justice Souter as the only justice with experience as a trial judge.
We're going to learn a lot about Sonia Sotomayor as the confirmation process begins, and there are already signs that it's going to be a heated confirmation process. But aside from the Clarence Thomas confirmation, where the Anita Hill surprise dominated the headlines for weeks in the United States some decades ago, the surprises usually take place on the court. Noah Feldman, regardless of how this confirmation hearing goes, what is the capacity of a Supreme Court nominee to surprise on the bench? And you can speak from personal experience, I believe.
I did work for Justice Souter, and he's certainly an example of somebody not everyone whom understood the trend of his thinking when he went on the court. I would say that in historical terms, most justices who change have historically become more liberal. There are only a few cases, most notably Justice Felix Frankfurter, who was perceived as having become more conservative when he sat on the court. But in the modern era especially, the vision is typically that people who are perceived as middle of the road or conservative end up being more liberal than was expected. Justice Kennedy, presently sitting, is another example of somebody who, appointed by Ronald Reagan, ended up making some pretty important liberal decisions. That's the most common trend line.
Now, is this something about the nature of the court? The Supreme Court justice job itself is one of extraordinary autonomy, a lifetime appointment. Once you get into the job, you see the world differently. Or is it something about the confirmation process that really misses the real core of what these justices are likely to do in the future?
It's both. On the one hand, most judges, and Sotomayor, Judge Sotomayor is one such, have only decided Court of Appeals decisions where there's not that much autonomy in the hands of the judges. The judges really have precedent that they have to follow. It's not up to them to make new law. By contrast, on the Supreme Court, almost every case that the court hears does not have a clear or a simple answer, and that's why the Supreme Court justices disagree with each other so frequently. So it's hard to know for sure how someone is going to rule when you confirm them. By the same token, it's also true that in broad terms, our Supreme Court has over the years expanded rights much more than it has contracted them. We have broader rights to autonomy and to liberty and to equality than the Founding Fathers may originally have envisioned. And so the justices tend to fall into that same pattern of gradually and sometimes cautiously, sometimes not so cautiously, expanding our liberties, and that makes them seem more liberal.
John Schwartz, Sotomayor replacing David Souter, it has been said again and again on this program and elsewhere that because she's replacing Souter and because she's a known liberal, that her impact on the court is likely to be nil in terms of the voting. Anthony Kennedy will remain the swing vote. What's your assessment of that, John?
Well, a new person changes the dynamics of the court. Everything happens. You get into judicial conferences, you get into conversations, and the power of personality affects the mix. And so just saying that the vote will be the same is not the same.
You know, we've talked on this program a lot about the idea, the capacity of a justice to persuade other justices. Noah, what do you think the capacity of Sotomayor is to be a persuader and a convincer of other justices, a real activist jurist?
It's, again, very difficult to know in advance. She's got years of experience as a judge, and that means she knows the collegial rules that judges follow amongst themselves. The way they convince each other of things might be, in certain ways, more subtle, more cautious, and more respectful of each other than the way, let's say, academics, to use an example, might try to convince each other of things. And she certainly is well-schooled in those ways.
Mm-hmm.
That said, you know, sometimes it takes years to bring someone over to a new position, and it's difficult to know what the interpersonal dynamics will be. Justice Sotomayor will be, if she is confirmed as a justice, will be the sixth Catholic on the court, which is fairly extraordinary.
Oh, but that's interesting.
Broadly speaking, seem quite different from those of some of the others on the court who tend to be on the conservative side.
Well, just quickly in terms of demographics, you mentioned the six Catholics, but, you know, at what point does a candidate's demographics help or hurt that person in, for example, confirmation hearings, in public opinion?
Well, I think part of it depends upon, if you're thinking about how the other justices relate to the person, there might be a tendency to be respectful of the person's perspective on a case that seems to touch on an area of their special expertise, and that doesn't have to only do with ethnicity. Justice Ginsburg was a professor of civil procedure, and when a civil procedure issue arises, the other justices look at her, and though they may not agree, they tend to respect what she has to say. Justice Thomas on the court has had a very distinctive set of ideas about the rights of African Americans, and he, of course, is the only African American presently sitting on the court. But typically, he's the only person who votes the way that he does. So the other justices don't defer to him, even though he has a distinctive perspective. So you really could get either end of the stick. I think it's possible that the other justices would say on an issue that seemed to be relevant to Justice Sotomayor's background that she has some idea of what she's talking about, but they might think, well, she knows what she's talking about, but I fundamentally disagree.
Well, Noah Feldman, the surprises will apparently begin once the confirmation hearing is over. Noah Feldman, Bemis Professor of Law at Harvard University, joined us from Cambridge, Massachusetts. And thanks, as always, to John Schwartz, legal writer for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, John. And now Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you, John. 28 minutes past the hour. President Obama is focusing his attention on clean energy and the economy today. He is expected to tour an Air Force base in Nevada that uses solar power. He will also discuss progress on his $787 billion stimulus package. And the president is expected to wrap up several fundraising appearances as well. President Obama is weighing in on the trial of democracy activist in Myanmar. The Asian country is also known as Burma. He calls on the government to immediately release Aung San Suu Kyi without condition. She's currently on trial for violation of her house arrest by offering shelter to an American man who swam to her home uninvited. A verdict is expected today. Suu Kyi has been set to be released today after her latest six-year detention. And a new survey shows that most leading economists predict the recession will end this year. Most think that economic growth could be back by the third quarter. And this comes from a survey of leading forecasters by the National Association for Business Economists. And that is a look at your news for now. Farai.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, in with John Hockenberry, and now we're going to turn to some stories on parenting. We don't mean just the small issues. We mean some very big ones. Yesterday, a Minnesota judge ruled that the parents of 13-year-old Daniel Hauser can regain custody of their son as long as he gets the cancer treatment doctors say he needs. Last week, the state of South Carolina set out to determine whether a child's level of obesity is enough to charge neglect. We're not talking a couple of pounds here, but hundreds of pounds. So where do we draw the line on parental negligence? Where should society and parenting interact? We're asking that question of you. Peggy from New Jersey weighed in.
Often there are some pretty nasty side effects from surgery or chemotherapy, and it could be that in the parent's eyes, they're not sure that the benefits to the child will outweigh the suffering in the short term.
Okay, so against medical advice, that's what doctors tell you you're doing if you do not follow their orders. Have you ever done that for your child? Just said, no, I'm sorry, doctor, we're not doing that, or to a teacher? Or to a lady in the grocery store who you think is nosy. Tell us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. What do you do if you don't want to follow what other folks say about your kids? Here with us is Kate Daly. She writes the Human Condition blog at Newsweek, and you can find a link there on our website to hers. She has been following these cases. Morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
The case of the kid who has cancer has gotten much more attention, but I actually want to start out with the obesity case, an unusual child neglect case, because we think of neglect being, you know, a kid, you know, shackled to a household appliance who doesn't get anything to eat. What's going on here?
Right. Well, we don't know fully what's going on in the Alexander Draper case. We do know that he's 14 years old and 555 pounds, and we do know that the state was looking to assume custody for his health care for something that had to do with his weight. Now, the Department of Social Services has come out and said it's not, we would never step in just because a child is heavy, but there's some underlying issues that's related to do with his weight, whether it's a condition that's causing his weight, whether it's diabetes brought on by his weight. We're not sure yet. They're not releasing a ton of information because he is a minor, but it does raise some really interesting questions about the difference between parental neglect and parental medical neglect, which are two very different things.
Mm-hmm. Explain more.
Well, like you said, when you think of parental neglect, you think of a kid shackled to the radiator. You know, you think of neglect implies people who have stopped caring. With medical neglect, parents often care very much. They just either aren't able to provide for their kids despite their best efforts, or they're very invested in their kids' medical care, but their ideas about what constitutes proper medical care is kind of at disagreement with the best accepted practices of how to care for a sick kid.
Well, in that case, we have the case of the Housers. 13-year-old Daniel Hauser is someone who has a form of cancer. And let's listen to a little bit of his former treating physician.
He needs to be retreated. The tumor is regrowing, so he could develop symptoms soon and get sick again. So there is some urgency, but I think if he does get treatment, he still has a very good chance of being cured.
Well, how does the whole question of medical neglect play out there? That if you take a kid who has cancer away from treatment, is that actionable under the law?
Absolutely. I mean, the law, a lot of times you hear the phrase the best interests of the child bandied about. That's really not the right way to look at cases like this, because the parents think that they have the best interest of the child when they want to treat his cancer with holistic therapies instead of chemo. So, best interest really isn't the best way to look at it. The law is pretty cut and dry. If you are denying a child treatment or care that's going to harm him, then that's medical neglect.
But when does that become a situation where the doctor overrules the personal liberties of a family? I mean, it seems to me implicitly in that doctrine, the law says a doctor can call what constitutes neglect or not.
Right. Well, I mean, the law's been pretty clear since about 1944 when they decided, look, if you want to be a martyr for your religious faith, that's fine, but you can't make a martyr out of your kid. The law really doesn't care what your intentions are, whether it's because you have religious objections, whether it's because, you know, every time a family member's gone into the hospital, they've passed away, so you're reluctant to take your child to the hospital. I mean, they're really just looking at, is the kid getting the treatment they need to live? And if not, that's neglect.
But, you know, the other thing, which reminds me of the first case that we talked about, the obesity case. I remember when I grew up in Binghamton, New York, there was a family that lived on our block, the Murphys, and the mom and dad were both gym teachers. And they used to comment on, they would see a kid who seemed overweight to them. And I remember Mr. Murphy used to say to me, those parents should be taken out and shot. We have a sense in this country that we can comment on other people's parenting, and that bleeds its way into the political discussion of what constitutes neglect, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's been very interesting to watch the reactions to both the Hauser case and the Draper case, because in the Hauser case, you have a lot of people saying, you know, the government shouldn't interfere, and the parents should be able to make this decision. And the Draper case, when you're dealing with obesity, there are some issues of race, there are some issues of class. You have people more likely to say, you know, that woman is a menace and she should be, her son should be taken away from her.
You mentioned the race and class aspects of this, but there's also a question of who's intervening in these, because there's, of course, been this whole feeling that people who are poor and people of color are more highly scrutinized by state entities for their parenting. Who gets to scrutinize people for bad parenting, and when bad parenting becomes illegal, illegal parenting?
In terms of medical neglect, a lot of times you'll have doctors or the Department of Social Services stepping in. And when you talk about, you know, is there going to be a nutrition police? Is there going to be a donut police? While the law, while there might be some wiggle room in the law, although they mostly talk about immediate harm, the truth is these agencies are so underfunded, they're so understaffed, that really only the most dire cases are getting the attention and are coming up on charges of medical neglect. Are those cases most often parents who are very poor? Yeah. I mean, we're seeing that much more than we see these religious freedom cases, which is why they make the news more than cases like Alex Draper make the news.
All right, Kate, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And Kate Daly writes the blog Human Condition for Newsweek. Femi Oke does the headlines for The Takeaway. Hey.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee said today that he can't imagine a filibuster against Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Senator Jeff Sessions says that he doesn't mean that GOP lawmakers won't give her a serious vetting, but if she is confirmed, Sotomayor will become the nation's first Hispanic justice to sit on the nation's top bench. In medical news, cancer deaths are dropping in the United States. The news comes according to the American Cancer Society. It says that the cancer death rate fell by 2% in 2006. Fewer people are smoking, and better detection and treatment are thought to have caused the drop. A Russian technology investment firm has invested $200 million for a 2% stake in Facebook, and that pegs the company's worth at around about $10 billion. It is an estimate, though, because Facebook is not a public company, so its actual market worth is not known. And that's a look at some of the stories topping the headlines this morning for I.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. Rob Watson now, defense correspondent for the BBC World Service, to talk about a huge explosion outside a police building in the Pakistani city of Lahore. 23 people dead, 250 injured by the latest count. Rob, thanks for joining us. And what is the significance of this attack? It's certainly rippling across Pakistan this morning.
Well, good to be with you, John. I think there's two bits to the significance angle, and that is, one, the target, because the bomb exploded, the car bomb exploded very near to the offices of the National Intelligence Service, the ISI, the notorious ISI, and also very near to the headquarters of the local police chief. Now, as to the timing, one clearly has to see this against the backdrop of what is the most massive military operation that the Pakistani has mounted internally for over 30 years, which it's currently fighting in the northwest of the country.
Now, the Pakistani military is planning on opening a new front in this initiative against the Taliban. First of all, any Taliban claim of responsibility in this bombing? And, you know, how is the media in Pakistan covering this in terms of it being a possible reaction to the military initiative against the Taliban in Swat?
Well, as far as I'm aware, John, nobody has yet claimed responsibility. But I think it would certainly be fair to say that the Pakistani authorities were expecting something like this. And if you think back to just over a week ago, there was a bomb outside a cinema, a car bomb outside a cinema in Peshawar, which is the capital, if you like, of Northwest Frontier Province, where this huge military campaign is going on. And I think it's fair to say that the authorities and indeed the Pakistani media were thinking, well, there are bound to be other retaliatory strikes. There are likely to be retaliatory strikes in Pakistan's other big cities.
Well, there's complexity here, and that's why we're grateful to have you on the air with us. So the ISI, if I'm not mistaken, is known to have been a supporter of the Taliban during the Afghanistan experience. Is it possible that the ISI is working against the Taliban here? And is there a way of distinguishing between Afghan Taliban and Pakistani Taliban for the purposes of this particular incident?
Boy, is that the $64,000 question, and one, of course, that intelligence and military services in Western countries, in particular the United States and Britain, are constantly scratching their heads over all the time. There certainly is a feeling amongst Western analysts that perhaps at last the ISI has cut its links with the Taliban, both the Pakistan and Afghan side. But of course, as you rightly point out, there is a lot of history here, and it's well known that the ISI were instrumental in the formation of the Afghan Taliban, and that there are known to have been links between the ISI and the creation of various Islamist extremist groups inside Pakistan. So I guess if you asked, does anybody think that these links have been cut entirely, the answer would be no. Is there some sort of sense or some hope that the ISI has come to the conclusion that perhaps these people are more trouble than they're worth? Then certainly there is a hope that they have reached that kind of conclusion.
Rob, Ahmed Rashid writes in the New York Review of Books that Pakistan is on the brink. Meanwhile, the U.S. State Department suggests that this initiative against the Taliban is exactly what's needed. You want to call it brink or moving back towards stability before we go?
Well, I think just very briefly, there is a great deal of encouragement being taken in the West that the Pakistanis have mounted this counterinsurgency operation. But I guess people are clinging to the ends of their seats to see whether it works or not.
And we're with them all. Rob Watson, defense correspondent for our partners, the BBC World Service at Bush House in London. Thanks as always, Rob.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Now we have Femi Okay with the headlines. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Fry. The time is almost 12 minutes to the top of the hour. New developments this morning mean that General Motors is almost certainly going bankrupt. GM now says that not enough of its bondholders are willing to swap debt for company stock. GM has until Monday to file for Chapter 11. Chrysler is already in bankruptcy court, and today it has a key court hearing. The car company will officially ask for final permission to sell to Fiat. Before the Italian automaker can close the deal, the court will hear from various parties opposing the sale, including dealers, investors, and former employees. New recordings of Illinois Senator Roland Burris have him asking former Governor Rob Blagojevich's brother for help getting the Senate appointment. Now, in the transcript, Burris is hesitant about holding a public fundraiser, but offers to personally write a check to Blagojevich. Burris's attorney says that his client has been truthful about all of his Blagojevich contacts. And finally, we head to Rome, where Vatican Radio is making news.
Vatican Radio, world news.
In the headlines this Wednesday morning.
Now, the lead story on Vatican Radio this morning is all about North Korea, but the Pope's broadcasting service is also making news. For the first time in its 88-year history, Vatican Radio will take adverts. The commercial start in July, and the first advertiser is an Italian energy company. But the head of Vatican Radio says he won't be taking adverts from just any company. So no food, no clothes,
KY.
No shoes.
No.
Okay, very specific kinds of adverts. That's a look at your news for now. Back to you, Fry and John.
Thank you.
Thank you, Femi. Okay, folks, adverts. I got to talk to you about that, Femi. Okay, folks, we've got a treat for you. Any of you brushing your teeth right now? Turn off the water in the sink. If you're driving, your windows are rolled down, I want you to roll them up, turn down the AC fan, take a breath, And check this out.
Know something, but he don't say nothing, he just keeps rolling, keeps on rolling along.
Well, I'm gonna let the goosebumps settle there. That's the voice and piano of Henry Butler, recorded live last night right here at WGBH at a concert which was as unusual as it was electrifying. Before a packed house, the blind Henry Butler played two full sets along with an ensemble of sign language interpreters, closed captioners, audio describers, a visual artist who painted a huge canvas along with the music. It was a concert for everyone, regardless of disability, and it seemed to intensify the art. Henry Butler is with me in the WGBH studios, along with Charlie Washburn, executive director of VASA Arts of Massachusetts, who sponsored the concert. Henry and Charlie, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure.
What was it like? You got a question from the audience saying, with all those people doing all those various things for people with various kinds of perceptual disabilities, was it like being in a band?
Well, it was like being in an ensemble. I would do one thing, they take that and play with it and create something new, perhaps. I felt, as I said last night, like a generator. You know, I was sort of putting ideas out there and playing songs that they were interpreting and they were translating and captioning. And so it was fun to be a part of that group.
Charlie, what's the vision of this kind of inclusion by design method of creating performance art so that everyone with any disability can experience it regardless?
Well, we've built this out of our experience with school children. We understand that taking a multi-arts, multi-sensory approach to instruction and learning allows us to make the experience in the schools more effective and beneficial for all students together. So we've built on that, and in pursuit of a vision, our overall vision at VSA Arts is to promote a society, to accomplish a society in which the engagement of people with disabilities is a commonly held expectation.
So you had deaf members of the audience observing what really felt like dance of the interpretation, not of just the lyrics in literal sign language, but of the motions and the rhythms of the music. It was a tremendous sort of dance troupe right there next to Henry.
Absolutely. And one of the sign interpreters was actually speaking in American Sign Language as a first language because he was deaf. So And the interplay also with the painter.
Nancy Ostrowski, visual artist Nancy Ostrowski.
Yes. You can see the sign interpreters responding to the painting as it was evolving, responding to Henry.
Well, Henry Butler, you are no stranger to this idea of exploring a world that you don't have the sense to actually explore, like so-called normal people. You've been blind since birth, right?
That's right.
And Dylan, do you have a cut number two to play for us?
I think I'm more alive when I'm making a choice to do something, when I'm making a choice to act, whether it be in photography or whether it be in a musical setting. The fact that I can act makes me feel good. It is the moment that's important to me, the instant. It's a conscious choice, even though I don't see the object, even if I'm getting a description, I could very well decide not to take that picture.
So here you are 14 years ago, and this is kind of a reunion for you and me, Henry. Yes. We did a documentary, a radio documentary together about what it's like for you to be not just a blues pianist, but a photographer. Blind person taking pictures and having the story told on the radio seemed like an insane project to me, but by the end, I was in tears. Why take pictures if you're blind, Henry?
Well, why do anything if you're anything? You know, and I think it's a wonderful thing. First of all, I think that every human being can do anything they want to do. They just have to know that they can do it. And unfortunately, that's not the kind of training that we get. That's not how we're educated. But sooner or later, if they start to experience special kinds of things, they start to realize that, most people start to realize after a while that they can pursue things that they're not expected to pursue.
But you know what was amazing to me? Tromping around the Brooklyn Bridge, taking pictures, your pictures, and getting them developed. This was before digital photography.
Yes.
I was looking at those pictures with you. I remember this to this day. And as I looked at the pictures you took, I thought, I have an idea of what it's like to be Henry. Just from looking at the pictures, even though you couldn't see them. It was remarkable to me how much of an insight into you the pictures gave me, even as you loved hearing me describe those pictures to you as a blind man.
Well, I that's one of the parts of this whole thing that I really love, listening to people describe the photos that I've taken. Because I know that if I show the same photo to 12 people, I'm going to get 13 different responses.
Right.
And that's fine. That's a lesson for me. That tells me that each person's intellect is a little different. The way each person interprets is going to be a little different based on their acculturation, based on their education, based on other things in their background.
Right. Well, blind photographers, deaf singers, it's all possible in the world of Charlie Washburn. Where can listeners find out more about this universal design performance technique and aesthetic? And then I want to go out on some more Henry's music.
Well, we are available on the web at vsamass.org, and we'll be bringing this idea as far and as wide as our partnerships, like the one with WGBH and the Takeaway, can take us.
All right, Henry Butler, New Orleans piano legend and blues man, and Charlie Washburn, executive director of VSA Arts of Massachusetts. Let's just listen.
He don't plant us. That plant them, they're soon forgotten.
Thanks, Henry Butler. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Judge to get jury trial.
I find endless challenge in the complexities of the law. I firmly believe in the rule of law as the foundation for all of our basic rights.
Belief in the rule of law may not reduce the challenges to the confirmation of Judge Sonia Sotomayor. Complexities of the law meet the politics of the United States Senate. This battle just might clear the bench. Reports from the legal dugout about the judge who saved baseball. That's right. Full coverage on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
So So you think I'm kidding? She saved baseball. She stopped the strike back in the 90s. It's Wednesday, May 27th. I'm John Huckenberry. Today I'm in our partner studios at WGBH in Boston. Farai Chidea is with us from New York. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. Coming up this hour, maybe the government shouldn't be in the marriage business at all. Talking about gay and straight couples both, we're going to talk with a legal scholar who's got a novel and controversial idea for a truce in the gay marriage war. Plus the Chinese connection behind the scenes as the U.S. tries to nudge China into pushing North Korea. All this and more ahead, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, 100 years a corporation, well, General Motors in its 100th year is almost certainly going bankrupt. Today, GM says not enough of its bondholders are willing to trade their debt for company stock. Chrysler, already there, it's got a key court hearing on details today. The car company will officially ask a court for final permission to sell itself to Fiat. But before the sale, Italian automaker has to get approval from various parties opposing the sale, including dealers, investors, and former employees. Farai?
The California Supreme Court ruling upholding gay marriage bans has protesters in the street.
Shame on you! Shame on you! Shame on you!
Gay rights supporters in San Francisco after the court upheld Proposition 8. Gay marriage foes are praising the court's decision on the November referendum. Thousands of same-gender couples married before the ban kicked in, and the court says their marriages are still valid. The recession is going to end this year. That, at least, is what a group of top economists think. A new survey by the National Association for Business Economics has most forecasters predicting the recession will be done by the end of 2009. But even if that proves technically true, unemployment will stay high, 9.1% this year, they think. John?
What's a technical layoff? I'd love to feel
a technical layoff is when your checks bounce. Yeah.
I guess. North Korea amping up threats today, possibly processing more nuclear fuel. It promises, quote, strong military measures, unquote, if South Korea stops and searches any North Korean ships, inspecting them for weapons of mass destruction. South Korean media reports steam rising from North Korea's nuclear facility, a possible sign, according to analysts, that the government is weaponizing its nuclear fuel. Fry?
Well, when you take a look at sports, you have a fabulous array of superstars. I know someone who has a huge crush on LeBron James. I won't say who, but he scored 44 points last night, yet it wasn't enough. The Orlando Magic beat the Cleveland Cavaliers, taking a 3-1 lead in the Eastern Conference Final. John?
The Dow gets going at 84.73. S&P starts trading at 9.10. Confirm Sonia Sotomayor. Give a question at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. It sounds like I was screaming my voice out at the Red Sox game last night, but no, I was at a great concert here at our partners, WGBH, in Boston, so I was up a little bit late. But the big story today is the confirmation of Judge Sotomayor, President Obama's nominee to replace David Souter on the Supreme Court. Let's listen once again to Sotomayor's very humble and very reverential reaction to being nominated.
I chose to be a lawyer and ultimately a judge, because I find endless challenge in the complexities of the law. I firmly believe in the rule of law as the foundation for all of our basic rights.
Sounds simple enough, yet there are endless challenges for senators and the people responsible for confirming Sotomayor in determining what it is about a justice that determines their qualifications for the high court. Joining us now is Jeffrey Rosen, law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor for The New Republic. His story in this week's magazine is called What's a Liberal Justice Now? Jeffrey Rosen, who joins us from Kansas City, Missouri, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
What are the sources for determining the identity and the likely qualifications and behavior of a judge on the Supreme Court? You've got the opinions, you've got people who've worked with this justice, and you've also got a public record if that person is a public person. Anything else?
You know, it's so tricky because the greatest predictor of judicial performance turns out to be judicial temperament.
And that's something that's very hard to discern from the written record. It's hard to define. It has to do with interactions with colleagues, humility, ability to compromise, to put the institution's interests before your own interests. These are all intangible things. You kind of know it when you see it, as one justice said, but very, very hard to bring out in the confirmation hearing. And certainly past confirmation hearings have not been very effective in actually predicting the kind of temperament that justices are going to bring to the bench.
In fact, the very public confirmation hearing could not be more at odds with the kind of mystery that shrouds all justices. We deliberately create kind of mysterious figures out of them. You attempted to determine the identity of Sotomayor by polling some of the people who have clerked with her. It's kind of like assessing buzz about a legendary sort of person in the kind of cloudy Olympian firmament. What was that like?
Well, it certainly was a controversial thing to try to do, and I guess I learned a lot from the experience. People who'd clerked with her for other judges and also prosecutors who'd appeared before her had said she could be kind of tough on the bench, and they felt that maybe she was a little hard to appear before. And then there's this resource called the Almanac for the Federal Judiciary, which is a kind of rate my professors for judges. Essentially, it polls lawyers, and all the comments are anonymous, and they kind of ask people to talk about the temperament of the judges. And there, too, many of Sotomayor's reviews were basically said she was tough on the bench and said maybe not as judicious as some of the other judges. But on the other hand, lots of people, as we've seen from the reaction to the nomination, just speak incredibly highly of her. Her colleagues say that they can get along really well with her. So figuring out exactly who has the full picture, who should be trusted, it's a hard thing to do, and I certainly wouldn't try to predict it with confidence in any way.
Although some of the quotes you got from those clerks are likely to be ammunition in the confirmation hearings, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm sorry about that, and I do regret the fact that conservatives are using that initial article as an argument against her, because I never intended it like that. The goal was just before the nomination came down to try to figure out what people thought of her temperament, which is the most relevant thing in nominating a judge. But I said then, and I've certainly said yesterday, and we'll say now that she absolutely should be confirmed. She's extremely well-qualified. There's really no good basis for opposing her, and I don't think she really will be opposed. I mean, the politics of this are so overwhelmingly positive that when the Republicans think about this, they're going to realize that they don't have much to stand on, and I think she's going to go through pretty well.
Well, we are asking people, Jeffrey, to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We have these questions that come up. And the one we're asking now is, if you were sitting on a confirmation hearing, what question would you get to ask Judge Sotomayor? Again, 877-8-MY-TAKE. But now, since I've got you directly on the line, I'm going to ask you that question. If you were to take her to a confirmation hearing, what would Senator Rosen?
Yes. Senator Rosen, you have the floor. Yes.
Senator Rosen would do a far worse job than the real senators. But I think I would ask, what do you think about a question like genetic selection or human cloning? I would really want to fast forward 20 years and not ask about abortion or the controversies of today, but the ones that are likely to come down the line. And there the alliances are so unusual when it comes to things like genetic selection. They're opposed both by social conservatives and also by feminists who think that genetic selection can lead to the favoring of boy babies over girls. So just by asking her to think about something that is not on the radar screen now but would really test her judicial philosophy, I think that could be really revealing.
Well, that brings in the whole issue of communications law. With the proliferation of all this kind of texting technology and all the ways we communicate, are there civil libertarian questions in there that you would want to get her answers on?
Wouldn't it be great to ask her about sexting? That would be a fun thing on the air, which is definitely in the cloud right now. But yes, indeed, the central question for the future of the First Amendment is that the great gatekeepers of the future are not going to be, unfortunately, the New York Times and the traditional media, but places like Google or Comcast, which blocked NARAL's pro-choice abortion messages. And what do you do when private companies have more power over free speech than the government used to? And how do you think about that? That's something that the next justice is going to have to think very deeply about.
I love how this Senator Rosen thinks, Farai. What do you think?
I think that we could go even a step further. If you have cloned yourself in order to produce an offspring legally, is that person your child, or is that person not your child?
You know, that is not at all a hypothetical question. People have noted that in the future, a gay couple might want to have a child who's biologically related to both men. So it'd be possible to take a cell from any part of the body, a stem cell, coax it from one man into an ovum, fertilize that with the sperm of the other man, have a child who's biologically related to both men. You can imagine people wanting to do that. What if Congress tried to ban that, said you can't have that sort of human cloning? Would that be constitutional or not? I mean, the mind reels, but really interesting to get a nominee to
wow.
think about that
and
sort
she,
of
and she hasn't even weighed in on the glow-in-the-dark kitty, which we also have, thanks to genetic manipulation. We've gone a little far afield here, but do you foresee that there's going to be anything that emerges that deals with race and ethnicity, specifically the fact that if confirmed, she will bring a Latino perspective into a court that has often viewed racial issues as black and white?
Yes, indeed. And there's one quote that has been getting a lot of attention. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor famously said, a wise old man and a wise old woman judge should reach the same result. And Sotomayor said, I would hope that a wise Latina woman with the richness of her experience would more often than not reach a better conclusion than a white man who hasn't lived that life. And that just raises all sorts of interesting questions about whether, it's true or whether the experience of Justice Clarence Thomas shows that you can be an African-American and not necessarily empathize in that sort of way. It's just a very rich, controversial debate that I'm sure will
sure
come up a lot.
Well, finally, Jeffrey, I mean, she grew up in the Bronx in the shadow of Yankee Stadium, credited to have saved baseball during the strike in the 90s. What does that say to corporate lawyers who might be looking for her decisions on labor law on the court? Finally, before we go.
You know, I think this is really the central question because we don't have a single economic populist on the Supreme Court. Even the Democrats tend to be very pro-big business. My sense is, you know, she was a corporate litigator, so... I haven't read all of her business opinions, but I'm not sure that she's an economic populist in the William O. Douglas models.
The William O. Douglas model, there's an interesting one. It's a mystery and definitely a place to look. We'll see if it comes up during the confirmation hearings. Baseball and everything else. Jeffrey Rosen, as always, thanks so much for being on the program. Jeffrey Rosen is a law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor for The New Republic. His story in this week's New Republic is called What's a Liberal Justice Now? What indeed. Thanks again, Jeffrey. So we're convening a confirmation hearing, right, Farai?
Mm-hmm.
Judge Sonia Sotomayor, America wants to get to know who she is. Make yourself a senator. You have the floor. What's the one question you want to ask her? It could be personal or professional. Just tell us your question at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Well, I think that usury laws would be an interesting one. People have debated whether the religious term usury should be applied against the credit card industry. And, if marriage is in some ways a hybrid between religious values and civil values, you have something like usury, which some local governments do use, that could be applied.
Well, certainly on the legislation that the Obama administration is drafting on credit cards, that's definitely coming up. You know, I want to settle one thing, though. The glow-in-the-dark kitty?
It's
real. I think it's settled. My kids have little glow-in-the-dark fish that they got at the pet store.
Yeah, and well, it was those fish genes that they modified into a cat. So
the
kitty
settled.
Is real.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
an impending confirmation hearing for Judge Sonia Sotomayor. I'm John Hockenberry here on The Takeaway with Farai Chidea. America's trying to get to know who this nominee is. We're convening the confirmation hearing right here on The Takeaway. What's the question you want to ask this nominee for America's highest court? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Farai?
Thanks, John. The California Supreme Court yesterday stopped any other same-sex couples from calling themselves married, even though they have many of the same rights. But what if marriage is just a word that really shouldn't be out in the civil discourse? What if you took the word away from gay people and straight people and just said, in terms of government purposes, everybody have a civil union? That is something that the conservative law professor Douglas Kemmick is proposing. He's at Pepperdine University in California, and he thinks his state will be forced to do just that after this ruling. Professor Kemmick, welcome.
Good morning.
We heard a bit from a California lesbian couple who we spoke to yesterday. We asked Janine Rizzo why marriage was so important.
Marriage is universal. It's not just in one state. It's not just in one country. It's a universal sense of the establishment of family. I think taking the word away is a compromise of the cultural integrity of it.
Well, when you think about that, you know, think about the way that she views it, is marriage universal?
Well, I think the way Jenny's viewing it is as if it was going to be available to some but not to all. You know, there's no question but that marriage is a foundation stone upon which the rest of society is built. It's an organizing principle, has been for millennia. And by virtue of that, the word has tremendous importance, which is why in California, when the people decided to restrict the use of the word to only a man and a woman, that is a tremendous discrimination. That is a forfeiture of the principle of equality, which is why the opinion that was issued yesterday by the California Supreme Court is really two-headed. On the one hand, the court is saying all of our citizens in California must be treated with equality. The principle of equality that they recognized in their earlier decision is affirmed. The court also went on to make it unquestionably clear that classifying people on the basis of their sexual orientation was suspect and should not be done. But at the same time, they said they were powerless to do anything other than to acknowledge that the people have the right to change the definition, or rather to reserve the definition to just one class of people in California. That produces, I think, the kind of anxiety that Jenny was reflecting. Because we get these forms that are passed out all the time by government that ask the question, are you married? Well, that becomes a discriminatory question when the categorization of marriage is reserved to some but not all. So the solution I propose is simply to take since the people of California have said it's only available for one part of the population, to take it away from all, to put the state on an even keel with everyone in terms of licensing, and then to have the definition of marriage be one that is simply confined, appropriately confined, in my judgment, to churches and religious societies.
Now, when you think about what exactly this ruling means, does it mean that marriage should be something which is redefined or something that is restricted? And what I mean by that is, do you think that marriage itself, it sounds like in some ways you think marriage itself is a proposition gone awry in the United States, and that has to do much more with how we're using the word in play in a civil context. Is that correct?
Well, I think the people of the judiciary in California has told us that the concept of marriage, the right of marriage, is one that belongs to all of us, straight or gay. That proposition was not changed by yesterday's ruling. And if you start with that premise as having been the conclusion in California culturally, then it seems to me you want to honor the ability of all to have access to that institution without any kind of substantive difference. Now, the concept of marriage can have, in addition to cultural meaning, it can also have distinctive religious meaning, and that differs among religious traditions. The Anglican and so forth is different than the Mormon and the Catholic.
Understood, but it seems like Prop 8 has made a very specific point about which takes precedence here, and I wonder if you could explore that for a second. I mean, there's this thought experiment, so maybe a justice of the peace married you, but if mom, you know, who's raised a Catholic, doesn't see, you know, daughter and son-in-law married in front of a priest, it doesn't count in her mind. It seems as though Prop 8 has basically enshrined that kind of mother-in-law's or mother's version of what constitutes a marriage into state doctrine in some way, and has not gone the other direction where marriage is a condition and there are these, like, religious decorations that distinguish different ceremonies. It seems to me Prop 8 is going in the other direction entirely.
Well, John, I think that's right, and that's, I think, one of the problematic features of it, because my proposal is one that I think is more consistent with our constitutional tradition of separating church and state, honoring both by that separation, whereas Proposition 8 has implicit within it a certain conception of marriage that indulges some people's faith traditions but not others. That is an entanglement of church and state, which is contrary to our constitutional traditions. And the court tried to grapple with this by limiting the effect of its ruling to the express terms of the proposition, namely that it only dealt with the name, the nomenclature. It didn't have anything to do with the actual substantive relationship between the people themselves, the couple themselves, mm-hmm. or the relationship between the couple and the state. The problem is that the name does have this powerful, as Jenny reflected, this powerful historical baggage to it, cultural baggage to it.
Well, Professor,
attempt to confine it was quite difficult.
Professor, there's much more to say, and we want to thank you for your time, Douglas Kamek, Professor of Constitutional Law at Pepperdine University. Now, a headline or two from Femi. Okay.
Two? Are you sure you want two whole
headlines? Yes, two whole headlines.
Do you know what? I'm not going to do headlines now. I will come back in 10 minutes and do headlines for you later. So I've just got so little time for but I will come back in 10 minutes' time where our top story, we're looking at cancer deaths dropping in the United States, and also the top Republican Senate Judiciary Committee saying that he doesn't foresee a filibuster problem with the Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. That's a look at your news very quickly. I'll see you in 10 minutes.
That's a headline.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea, in with John Hockenberry, and of course we have a new nominee for the Supreme Court, Judge Sonia Sotomayor. America's trying to get to know who she is. We want to know lots about her. What is she like? What does she think about jurisprudence? What do you want to ask her, personal question or professional? Tell us what you want to ask her, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. John?
So, Farai, let's review the bidding. North Korea continues to raise the stakes in its game of nuclear poker, or whatever it's called. Maybe it's roulette. Conducting a second nuclear test in as many days yesterday, today North Korea is threatening military strikes against South Korea if any of the North's ships are stopped and searched for weapons. South Korea had agreed to participate in such missions as part of an American-led effort at intercepting ships carrying weapons of mass destruction. Despite repeated condemnations by the so-called international community, most observers argue there's really only one player sitting at the table with North Korea, figuratively or literally. That's China. North Korea's neighbor, main trading partner, and probably the only one with the kind of leverage in the United Nations to actually make a difference to North Korea. Joining us now once again is John Pomfret, author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates in the Story of the New China. He writes the blog Pomfret's China on the Newsweek Washington Post website. He joins us from Bethesda, Maryland. John Pomfret, thanks for coming back to the program.
Hi, John. How are you?
Great. Let's talk about, first of all, how China is viewing what appears in American headlines to be an escalation by North Korea. Are they giving it the same significance as we're giving it here in the United States?
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, it's playing pretty big in Chinese newspapers. So, yes, they're viewing it with some alarm.
And what sort of leverage does China have over North Korea? Yesterday, John Bolton on this program said the Chinese could end this tomorrow. First of all, do you believe that? And secondly, is that something that the Chinese sort of say publicly?
Yeah, the Chinese do have an enormous amount of leverage over North Korea if they wish to exercise it. The problem is that their interests in the Korean Peninsula are not completely different, but quite different from those of the United States. So, I mean, the number one thing on China's list is they don't want North Korea to collapse. The number one thing on our list is we want the North Korean nukes to go away, and those are two very different interests.
Well, those divergent interests then would tend to argue with the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, who on ABC News said that the U.N. Security Council is united in condemning North Korea's actions. Listen to this, John.
And the message we're sending back is that the international community is united, North Korea is isolated. The international community will not be intimidated, and the pressure on North Korea will only increase if they continue on this course.
Of course, you're saying that the North Koreans know full well that China has very different interests than the rest of the international community, and are they exploiting that?
Definitely. I mean, the North Koreans understand that the Chinese government is basically completely behind the regime. I mean, they don't obviously want North Korea to do nuclear tests. They don't want the North Koreans to have a nuclear bomb. But if the cost of cutting out the North Korean nuclear program would be a collapse of North Korea, they'll let the North Koreans have the nukes.
Can I ask you a cynical question, John?
Sure.
It seems to me from a regional perspective, an argument can be made that the nuclear developments in North Korea, while alarming to China and South Korea to a certain extent, the fact that they're really alarming to Japan might be an indication that the Chinese and the South Koreans, who, you know, don't mind that the Japanese are terribly alarmed and annoyed, they might just let the Japanese get all worked up over this, and that they're not as likely to criticize North Korea in the same way that the Japanese do.
That's partially true. I think basically, but I think on this issue, China's interests are different than South Korea's interests. Basically, China doesn't want North Korea to collapse, because if North Korea collapsed, China's probably going to get about 2 million refugees in the Manchurian section of the country. China's also going to lose an enormous amount of South Korean investment, because all that South Korean investment is going to flow into North Korea. And thirdly, I mean, China is in the process of turning North Korea into a vassal state. Basically, you look at any North Korean mining operation, any substantial North Korean activity, and the Chinese have a piece of it. And if North Korea collapses, South Korea is going to take over that economic chunk. So China really its interests are different than South Korea's interests in this issue. Now, of course, they don't mind seeing the Japanese stew over there, you know, to their east, but their fundamental interest is that they have so much to gain from a continued existence of the Kim state in North Korea that they don't want to see that thing fall apart.
You're bringing up something, which is that China has become very aggressive in acquiring mineral rights all around the world, including in Africa. The relationship that you outline with North Korea begs a question to me, which is, do we have any idea of what North Korea's vision is for itself?
Well, I think North Korea's vision for itself is basically the continuation of the Kim dynasty, right? I mean, these guys just want to stay in power. And then, obviously, there's rumors about Kim's health. Is there a succession problem? Who knows? You know, if he goes, will his son take over? Those are all open questions. And if his son doesn't take over, are we going to get some strange general that's going to run the show? I mean, these are enormously important and very good questions, but we just don't have an idea of what's happening over there internally.
Including the question of, are there any non-strange generals in North Korea? John Pomfret, you want to guess a next move on the part of China before we go?
Yeah, the Chinese are going to, you know, hem and haw and say we got to sit down and continue the six-party talks.
There you have it. John Pomfret, author of Chinese Lessons, Five Classmates and the Story of New China. And now, just on time, Famioke's, here are the headlines.
Thanks very much, John. The time is coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. The top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee said today he doesn't foresee a filibuster against Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Senator Jeff Sessions didn't rule out backing Sotomayor's nomination himself, although he had opposed her nomination to the Federal's Appeals Court back in 1998. New recordings of Illinois Senator Roland Burris have him asking former Governor Rob Blagojevich's brother for help getting the Senate appointment. Now, in the transcript, Burris is hesitant about holding a public fundraiser, but offers to personally write a check to Blagojevich. Burris's attorney says that his client has been truthful about all of his Blagojevich contacts. Burris was scheduled to embark on a two-day tour of central Illinois today. Cancer deaths are dropping in the U.S. The American Cancer Society says that the cancer death rate fell by 2% in 2006. Fewer people smoking and better detection and treatment are thought to have caused the drop. In international news, the Pope's broadcasting service is making history. For the first time in its 88-year history, Vatican Radio will take commercials. The head of Vatican Radio...
Or adverts. Adverts, yes, sometimes they're called, yeah.
Yes, thank you. You're making fun of me now. Now, the head of Vatican Radio, from the safety of Boston, might I add, the head of Vatican Radio, Federico Lombardi, says that he won't be selling spots to just any company.
We have to be very careful which advertisement we accept. We are not selling every type of product, absolutely. We'll have so institutional promotion for very serious institutions.
The commercial start in July, and the first advertiser is an Italian energy company.
Not Madonna? Best of Madonna? Like a Prayer?
You are so in trouble with the Pope, Fry.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. If you are a nominee for the Supreme Court, like Judge Sonia Sotomayor, you can rest assured that questions will be asked about your rulings, your family, how you treated your former clerks, whether you should wear white after Labor Day. You know, anything. But what kind of robe will Sotomayor wear if she's confirmed? That's right. Justices are permitted to design their own robes. And the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist was famous for some flamboyant gold stripes. You can see a picture on our website, www.thetakeaway.org. And now joining us in studio, we've got Susan Scafati, law professor at Fordham Law School, who writes the blog Susan Scafidi, who writes the blog Counterfeit Chic. All right, Susan Scafidi, a law professor, a fashion critic. Which part do you like most?
Oh, it's combined. I get to teach fashion law for I, which is so much fun.
Oh, my gosh. So what are we really talking about here when we say that the justices design their own robes? Like, I guess you couldn't really do like a poof skirt with gold lamé high heels, right?
Well, technically you could, but tradition would dictate otherwise. In fact, in 200 years on the court, Justice Rehnquist is pretty much the only one who has gone his own way very dramatically. As you know, he went and saw Gilbert and Sullivan opera, liked the costumes, came back and added those stripes to his robes, but he's pretty unique.
Okay, so let's see. We've had a lot of talk about the South Bronx and Puerto Rico. You know, maybe we could get something like a little Puerto Rican flag on the back of the robe. No, yes.
Well, the thing about those black robes is they're intended to efface the individual, mm-hmm. so that the judges wearing them are speaking for justice and for the law, not for themselves. But I think that Judge Sotomayor may take a different perspective, or slightly different perspective, because as you know, she said she's not just another judge on the bench. She is a wise Latina woman sitting on the bench. And so she's not speaking only as a an officer of the court. She's speaking as a representative of a very different community. And she's shown her style in some interesting ways. If you look at pictures of her, she seems to really favor interesting flamboyant earrings. I hope she continues to wear those with her robes. In fact, she's just been nominated for a huge position. Judge, go out and buy yourself a new pair to celebrate.
That's right. I'm sure she is already lining up at the stores. Just quickly, what is the history of this tradition of, you know, letting justices take a hand in their own dress?
Well, actually, judges haven't had a history of taking too much of a hand in their own dress. In fact, there's been more of a tradition of uniformity, apart from small details that might allow the judge to be more comfortable. But going back to our very first Supreme Court judges, they wore not black, but black and red, sort of an echo back to England, although they ditched those big white wigs pretty early on. By 1800, though, all of our Supreme Court justices were wearing all black, and they have ever since. Now, one slight variation. First woman on the court isn't going to wear a shirt and tie under her robe. Sandra Day O'Connor had to choose something else to fill in that little triangle at the top. She chose a jabot, a white ruffled lace scarf, which is a lot more similar to what French judges wear. It's also what men wore in the 18th century to go out dancing, so not too modern. I think Judge Sotomayor might be able to do better.
At least we don't think we're going to go back to the floppy bow tie that insurance agents wore in the 80s if you were a woman. Anyway, Susan Scafidi, fascinating stuff. Law professor at Fordham Law School and part of the legal fashion police.
Absolutely, Farai.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Chidea in with John Hockenberry, and we have a new nominee for the Supreme Court. Judge Sonia Sotomayor will be talking in a few minutes with someone who knows her. But we want to ask you, what's the one question that you want to ask her? It can be anything you want, personal or professional. Tell us your query at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi has got the headlines.
At 12 minutes to the top of the hour, North Korea is amping up threats today and possibly processing more nuclear fuel. Now, it promises, I'm going to quote here, strong military measures, end of quote, if South Korea stops and searches any North Korean ships. Yesterday, the South joined an American-led program that can stop ships suspected of smuggling weapons. South Korean media reports steam rising from a North Korean nuclear facility. That could be a sign that the government is weaponizing nuclear fuel. 10 more years, that's how long the Army's top officer says that U.S. forces could be in Iraq and Afghanistan. General George Casey is the Army Chief of Staff. He made the comments at a briefing for journalists and scholars. He stresses that he's not the person making overall policy, but he says the military is preparing for a decade-long commitment. The current deal between the U.S. and Iraq requires all American troops to leave by 2012. President Obama is on a Western road trip. He's doing a lot of fundraising for Democratic candidates and all the time promoting federal programs and his Supreme Court nominee. Today, he'll tour a green energy site and raise more money in Los Angeles. And finally, the Orlando Magic are one game away from pulling off a huge upset over the Cleveland Cavaliers. Last night, Orlando won to take a 3-1 lead in the Eastern Conference Final. And Magic center Dwight Howard says the team is ready to win. Now, over in the Western Conference, the Denver Nuggets and the LA Lakers are tied up at 2-2, and they play the next game tonight. That's looking at your news for now. For I, John.
Thanks, Femi. And we have been bombarded about the details of the background and upbringing of a woman who may, in fact, be the first Latina on the Supreme Court. She grew up in the South Bronx in a housing project. A couple of folks have crossed her path and come to tell us a story about her. Right now, we're being joined by Jenny Rivera, who clerked for Sotomayor in 1993 and 1994. She's now a law professor at the City University of New York School of Law. We actually spoke to her yesterday while she was riding the bus, and thanks for joining us. Tell us more about what she was like as a boss.
Well, the judge is, was and certainly is, a wonderful boss. She is a person who has very high expectations, and so she really expects her clerks to meet those high expectations and everyone around her. So it's wonderful to be in an environment where you're pushed to do your best all the time. So it's a phenomenal training and mentoring experience that way. She's also, you know, on a personal level, a very caring and giving individual. She wants to know about what's going on in the lives of the people around her. She has lunch with the people she's working with. She's very funny and very engaging. So it's a nice blend of sort of this very high level of professionalism and an incredible work ethic, as well as someone who's also very caring and giving and wants to make sure that her clerks are doing well and are happy with the work. So she's really a lovely, lovely person to work for.
Well, you know, there was someone named Camille Proud who also used to work under Sotomayor, and she called in to the Brian Lehrer show on WNYC.
I worked at the Second Circuit. I was a low-level employee, and Judge Sotomayor, when she joined the court, she said, anyone come to my office, I'm happy to talk to you and help you in any way I can. I came in, and she sat with me, and she, you know, talked to me about my career in a way that, you know, most people in her position would not even consider doing. She's genuine. She's down to earth, and she, you know, she stands by her word. I'm an African-American woman from Brooklyn, and I feel more proud and teary-eyed about her nomination than when I did when President Obama was elected.
Was she a good mentor?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. As I say, you know, sort of the expectations of always pushing people to do their best, but also someone who really listens. She's a wonderful listener and really asked, sort of not just, you know, on the bench, the probing questions, but to people sort of what is it you're looking for, what is it you want to do, and she'd talk about sort of her own experiences and how she made certain choices and how they impacted her and so forth. So she's a wonderful mentor that way, and she does stay in contact with people. She's very generous with her time because she's extremely busy, so she's wonderful that way also. On that point that, you know, the caller made, that is such a wonderful point because Judge Sotomayor is able to connect with just a range of people, as you heard the caller say. And that is true. You'd go down, you know, to have lunch and just pick it up in the cafeteria. It's a very busy schedule. You may not have time to take a long break or go out. And, you know, people in the cafeteria who were working in all areas of the courthouse would say hi. She'd have a big right. smile. She'd greet them. So she's really engaging that way.
Well, Jenny Rivera, professor of law at the City University of New York, former clerk for Judge Sonia Sotomayor, thanks for joining us. John, now to you.
Let's turn to Columbia Law Professor Nate Persily for a bit on the challenges that Judge Sotomayor will face from conservatives. As the confirmation hearing gets going, Judge Sotomayor will not be among friends like Jenny Rivera. It'll be Republican antagonists. And if the confirmation hearing was held on talk radio or cable television, it might sound more like Rush Limbaugh here.
Here you have a racist. You might want to soften that, and you might want to say a reverse racist. And the libs, of course, say the minorities cannot be racists because they don't have the power to implement their racism. Well, those days are gone.
Columbia Law Professor Nate Persily, the 24-hour cable news cycle doesn't do the confirmation process any favors, it seems to me. What is the likely traction of these kinds of themes? She's a racist. She isn't a heavyweight. She doesn't have enough of a judicial record.
Well, the last criticism is meritless. I mean, everyone, I think, recognizes that she has more of a judicial record than anyone on the court and probably anyone who's been nominated to this position in 70 years. The question about identity politics or some of the things that she said in that Berkeley speech that Rush Limbaugh was quoting from will be raised. I mean, Barack Obama knew that this record existed out there. Part of what she has said in her speeches is directly related to the empathetic character that the president wanted to appoint to this position. And so she, what Limbaugh's referring to is her invocation of her Latina identity and being a woman and how that affects judges. And she is of the school of thought that, you know, your background makes a difference in how you judge and that two people from different backgrounds might come to different conclusions. And that will, as we're seeing in the NEM that's come out so far, is going to dominate a lot of the discussion about her.
Now, can the Republicans really turn the background story, which Barack Obama, let's face it, got elected on, his own personal background story, turn that into a liability for this justice?
Well, I think they are walking very gingerly right now, because I think they recognize that if you try to hobble the first Hispanic nominee to the Supreme Court, that there are political implications for that. But this is going to be used by some as a lens through which we view certain constitutional controversies, as is the case with every judicial nomination.
Well, let me toss a lens at you, Nate. You're a friend of the program, and we're among friends here. I don't think I'm using a Republican argument, but justices are supposed to be blind. Maybe it's wrong for a justice to use his or her personal story as an influencer in judicial decisions.
What she was saying is it's simply a fact that people's decisions about the Constitution and about how the law should be applied are going to be affected by their background. I mean, she was really making an empirical argument and saying that she's no exception to that rule. And I think that if you look at Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Alito, I don't think that their backgrounds have had no influence on who they are, whether it's working in the Reagan Justice Department or growing up where they did. All of these things have certain effects. In particular, though, I think that this plays into the criticism about affirmative action, identity politics, and some of the race issues that the Supreme Court will be dealing with, and that's going to be the way that they try to tie this argument to the constitutional issue she's going to be deciding.
Couple of seconds, Nate. Six Catholics on the court. If Sotomayor is confirmed, will it even come up in the confirmation hearings?
No. No one wants to offend Catholics. I think they're too big a voting bloc.
Columbia Law Professor Nate Persley, thanks so much for that context as we head into the confirmation waters. Just a little note here. The top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee says he doesn't foresee a filibuster against Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Farai?
Well, we're also asking folks, all of you, what do you want to ask Sonia Sotomayor if you were a senator? What would you do? What would you ask? We asked Jeffrey Rosen, a law professor at George Washington University and legal affairs editor for The New Republic, what he would ask as a senator.
I would really want to fast forward 20 years and not ask about abortion or the controversies of today, but the ones that are likely to come down the line. Just by, you know, asking her to think about something that is not on the radar screen now but would really test her judicial philosophy, I think that could be really revealing.
Well, you can tell us your query at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.